Please give your warmest Irish welcome to Dame Angela Lansbury. Perhaps because we're on stage in this beautiful theatre this afternoon, we might begin with theatre, but not with you here, but with you out there as an audience member, what you were going to see, and when you thought, maybe I'd like to do what they're doing up here.
Well, I had the good fortune to be married into a theatre family. My mother was an actress. Therefore, I had access to theatre at a very, very young age. Not that I enjoyed seeing my mother in the theatre. It worried me because she was often being, shouted at by characters. And that, as a child, upset me terribly, and I'd be taken screaming out of the theatre, into the waiting room. So the theatre had to grow with me. And as I reached my early teens, or even prior to that, my sister, who is 5 years ahead of me, went to drama school ahead of me. And so she was talking theatre, you see. So I was listening without even realizing what I was hearing. But I wasn't one of those children who wanted to get on the stage. Not at all. Not at all. I was very quiet and very retiring as a kid. So for me to blossom forth finally and revealed my theatrical instincts, it took a long time, actually. But my sister and I used to go to the theatre a lot, but mostly to musicals.
As you mentioned, your mother was an actress. She hailed from Belfast. Your father was English. Mm-hmm. What did that Irish-English mix bring to you, but both as a person and as a performer?
Interesting question. My mother came from a Protestant family, from the north of Ireland. Although her father was a solicitor, and he was very artistic. And he was one of the people who was at the Royal Opera House a lot, and he sang, and he encouraged my mother to recite, and she used to give recitations at the Opera House. So she was filled with drama and excitement, and so was he. She didn't get along very well with her mother, who didn't approve of any of it. So it was a hard slog for her, my mother. But she was a born actress. She really was. So a great deal of my talent came from her, yes.
The drama was in the genes. Sadly, your father died when you were very young, just 9. It was one of the first times that your mother brought you to Ireland, which, from what I can gather, Angela, became a place of retreat, of spiritual renewal for you. And we'll talk about Cork in a moment, but it was Achill, that visit, wasn't it?
Achill really got me at the age of 9. And we stayed in Douar, and the whole family and my mother's sister was with us. And we just sort of, it was a vast relief for us to come to Ireland. And we drove in an Austin 7, would you believe it? I sat in the front with her. You probably, none of you know what an Austin 7 was, but it was a teeny little car, and my twin brothers sat in the back seat. So it was an adventure, and the luggage was on top and on the back. So it was quite a trip, coming to Ireland the first time.
And talk to us about Cork. You've had two properties there over the years, but it really is your second home. Tell us about those two places that you called home.
Well, my first home in Ireland was in Conna, near Tallow, which is in Cork, And we bought a glebe house there, and we restored it to a great extent. And we brought our kids. This is my husband and I brought my children who were had fallen by the wayside badly with drugs in the States. And rather than do the normal thing, sending them off to some place that we didn't know, we thought we'll take them to Ireland. And we did, and it was enormously successful. They got off drugs. They worked. Some of them worked at Ballymaloe.
Myrtle Allen, right?
Yeah. And it was just a most healing time. And what I did is I went to work in the theatre in London. It was easy. I could go back and forth, play for four nights, and come back for the next three. And so we rebuilt our lives, really, in Ireland with our children. And I shall be forever thankful and grateful for that. And coming home, that's why it's always coming home. And I come home every year. I have a house in Cork still. That we built finally on the sea near Ballycotton. And we just love being here, and here I am. And I've been given the greatest honor that you can have in our business. And I feel, my goodness, I can breathe a big sigh and say, okay, I've done it.
Let's come, Angela, to when your mother made the decision that you should move from England to the United States. There was the threat of war. You went as the evacuee scheme initially. So you literally hopped on the boat.
We were evacuees. Yes, we were. We went to America, and we didn't have two pennies to rub together, honestly. My father's business had been bombed in the East End. He was in the in the veneer woods. He did veneer panels, and some of which were in the old Queen Mary ship, and still are, actually, which is in Long Beach, as you know. And we were actually supported by an American family. They gave us X number of dollars a month, and we lived in a summer house. And my mother immediately went to work to try and, in some way, get me back into my theatrical training again. And through meeting ladies in the neighborhood, she discovered a way of getting me a scholarship to a drama school. So I got to work, to go to work to school in New York. And that was the beginning of my training in the U.S.
The training began then, and your mother, I understand, went ahead to L.A. and you followed. In terms of being seen at all by MGM, getting a screen test, I would imagine there were so many young men and young ladies trying to get through that gate. How did you do it? How were you seen?
Well, that's a good question. Fortunately, MGM Studios was about to make a film of a wonderful play called Gaslight. And a friend of mine was up for a role in it. I didn't know what the play was particularly, but he did. And he knew that there was a part of this Nancy, who was the maid in Gaslight. So he got me an interview with the casting director. And I was allowed to go into the studio with my mother. I was underage, so I couldn't just be wandering in. I wouldn't have wanted to anyway. Anyway, or maybe I would. Anyway. Anyway, we went in, and we met the director, who was a very famous man. His name was George Cukor, and he was a very successful in that he had directed the great Greta Garbo and Joan Crawford and all of these elderly old ladies of that era. And so, I'm now one of them. Anyway. He was very nice to me indeed, and he had the writer who had written the script, who was an Englishman called John Van Druten. And John recognized my mother because she had been really a well-known West End actress, as you were called in those days. And so they were suddenly very friendly, and all for listening to this young woman who was a little overweight, but nevertheless appeared to be the right age, or a little bit too young perhaps, to play Nancy. So George Cukor gave me the script, and he said, I want you to go away and study this and come back and then read it for us, and we'll have somebody read the other role. So that's what I did, and that was the beginning. And then, of course, I made the test, and then I got the part. And can you imagine what that was? I mean, I had to tell them at the shop that I couldn't come the next week. Because I had a part in a film, you know. So it was a thrilling time, you know. We'd had nothing, absolutely nothing, you know. And suddenly we were in business and the family could take off. And I had my twin brothers with me, you see. They were there. They were, goodness knows what, they were about 12.
Mm-hmm. You had a contract now, as you say, you were financially stable, which was wonderful. George Cukor, who you mentioned there, paid you a really lovely compliment. He said, at just 17, you were immediately professional. I'm wondering where that came from. You were so young and you got it.
I don't know, honestly. It was just a wonderful given. And I think it was from being around adults very early in my life, you know. And it was a demand that I stepped up to the plate and delivered the goods, you know. And in those days, with the war going on, you couldn't just dither away. You had to take ground. And I think that was a great help to me.
A great role, your first Oscar nomination. You really put in the work, though. I mean, those days at MGM were 5 a.m. starts, weren't they?
Oh, you didn't sit around. You were used constantly, which was one of my problems, actually, because I was used a lot in awful parts that I didn't want to play, and they were far too old for me. So I became what we call a character actress, far too young.
I'm interested to know about the others of your age who were around at the time. You starred in National Velvet with Liz Taylor. You starred in The Harvey Girls with Judy Garland. Mm-hmm. Were you hanging around socially with them or just starring with them?
Elizabeth, of course, was much, much younger than me. And she was just kind of growing into herself and becoming the beautiful young woman that she did. And that was during the years that I was at MGM. Judy Garland was a huge star at that time when we did that film. And we certainly got along like a house on fire, and we used to travel in the car back and forth to the studio set together. But other than that, I saw her many, many times during the course of my career. What happened with me was that I sort of shot up at one point when I went into musical theater, because singing was something that was just easy for me. I loved it and I worked at it, but I took off in musical theater rather than stay in California and play not very good roles in movies at MGM. I preferred to take the chance. And of course, the chance took me to Stephen Sondheim, and that was the beginning of a wonderful page in my theatrical history, really.
It was good, though, you got to star in The Harvey Girls with Judy at the time.
Yes, but it wasn't my voice.
There you go.
So that'll give you an idea. But I don't blame them. They wanted somebody with a whiskey voice, and I just hadn't quite got the whiskey voice yet, you know. It came later.
You also worked with Frank Capra in State of the Union and amazing co-stars Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy.
Yes.
Was that a supportive set, to be honest, such with these three?
When you say supportive, I was certainly playing a supportive role. I was never made to feel that I was a supporting actress with them. They were the real thing, you know. Katharine Hepburn was a real tough cookie and terrific woman, really, in her own way. And he was a lovely fella. And they treated me as if I was an equal. And quite frankly, I allowed myself to bask in their kindness, because I had to. I had to play the role. And she was not a very nice character, you know. She was a very tough woman. So it's amazing the number of tough women I play. It's because I'm so afraid of tough women that I know how to make you worry.
That's interesting. Before we come to Broadway, just a quick word about some of those other, as you say, extraordinary characters you played. The mother roles in Blue Hawaii, playing Elvis's mother, Fall Down, playing Warren Beatty's mother. But Manchurian Candidate was a particularly special one. I know the director of All Fall Down, John Frankenheimer, gave you the book, which you were pretty blown away with. It has to have been a great role to play, Angela, was it?
Oh, yes. No question about it. It was a landmark role for me. And the last movie role that I did before I went to Broadway, I knew I couldn't top that, so I got out while the going was good and went to Broadway.
Is it fair to say they just weren't quite sure what to do with you in the studios in terms of casting?
It's absolutely true. They didn't know what to do. They didn't have the roles for me to play. And they wouldn't let me play the big starring roles that I might have enjoyed, you know, not enjoyed, but brought something to.
Well, thank goodness Broadway came a-knocking in the form of Stephen Sondheim's musical Anyone Can Whistle. When you were asked, what was your reaction?
I was stopped in my tracks. I've never been more excited, nor more challenged as a woman, as an actress, as a singer. I had really had to learn to sing Broadway style, you know, to be heard. And I really worked at it. So it was a good way to come out as a musical actress, because it led to other things. So wonderful, wonderful roles, you know, in musical theatre, which I wish I'd had a chance to do in London, perhaps. Some of you could have seen them, or come to Dublin and done them. But the opportunities didn't present themselves, and so I was stuck in New York, which is no bad thing, believe me. But the thing was that none of them were photographed. The only one that was photographed was Sweeney Todd. Mm. So nobody knows. Well, YouTube has a few bits and pieces on it.
Sadly, Anyone Can Whistle didn't work out in terms of audiences. It ran for just nine performances. But as you correctly say, one thing leads to another. And most importantly, the composer Jerry Herman was in the audience, saw Anyone Can Whistle, and he was about to cast Mame. Now, again, Angela, you had to work very hard to get that role. Was it three auditions?
Yes, three auditions with three different directors. The producers were... You know, they just didn't know whether I could bring that audience into the Winter Garden Theatre in New York, which had originally been a cattle barn. To give you an idea of the size of it, it was an enormous theatre. I don't blame them, but thank God they put their worries in their pocket and they said, OK, I'll never forget that.
I'm wondering as well, did your time in MGM, being around those musicals in rehearsal, help you? Because you had, in Mame, 28 costume changes. There were 12 numbers. You were involved in 10 of them. Big choreography as well. Were you ready for that? Had you seen rehearsals in MGM that you knew how to go for it?
I really had to work at it. And Bea Arthur, who was with me, played the other role. She and I, we worked very hard on the floor and doing our physical jerks to get in shape to do all of that. And it not only helped me with the movement and the dancing, but it helped my voice too. It strengthened me. So I was really kind of like an athlete, which you have to be in musical theatre, really, to sing and to dance at the same time, you know.
Playing Mame for 2 years on Broadway, I would imagine the excitement of the opening night, this incredibly glamorous time in your life. There must have been huge emotion on the closing night after playing that role for 2 years.
Oh, there was, yes. I remember, yes. Oh, I couldn't sing if he walked into my life. I just couldn't sing it.
Yeah, it has to have been huge. One of the things... It amazes me about this time in Hollywood, is that if you're a leading lady on Broadway, it means nothing to Hollywood. So we've seen it with Julie Andrews being in My Fair Lady, but then Audrey Hepburn being cast in the movie. Angela Lansbury plays Mame for 2 years. Lucille Ball is cast in the movie. It must be very hard to take.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It is. No question about it.
Madness. Well, we all think you should have been cast in the film, obviously. Post-Mame, the question is then, follow that, as we say here, how do you follow it? And so you stayed with Jerry Herman for his next musical.
Yes.
Dear World.
Dear World, of course. And that really appealed to me because it was a total character. Oh, my gosh, I got to wear the whole smear, you know, the face and the wigs, and I was playing a woman great deal older. But I loved doing that, you see. It wasn't anything like the success of Mame because I wasn't kicking my legs around and, you know, I just playing a great character role. So it was a disappointment. It ran for 6 months, which was a pretty good run, but not the kind of thing that they expect on Broadway, you know. Mm. They look for a year at least. So I'm sorry about that, but it was one of those, you know.
What was your reaction when you were asked to play the lead in Gypsy?
I said, I could never do that. I said, I don't think so, but I was sort of talked into it by Arthur Lawrence, the playwright, and certainly by Stephen Sondheim, and the composer, Julie Stein. They all kind of say, yes, you know, we'll work with you. We're going to help you. You know, we want an actress to play the part. This is what they kept going on about, was that they wanted, you know, they'd had Ethel Merman, who had the voice of a, you know, a dream voice for Broadway in those days when she was the queen of Broadway. But I was a different quantity. I was an actress who sang passably well, but I had the drama in me. That was the thing that they recognized, and they wanted me to bring all of that to Gypsy. And I could understand why, and I thought, well, I'll have a crack at it. So I did, and I don't know whether you know this, but we opened in London. We actually opened in London and came to New York later, which was a great way to do it. It was an odd way because we had an English cast. Well, English kids playing, roles of American kids and all of this, it was a little bit tricky, but it was okay. And of course, it's just been done again.
With Imelda Staunton,
with
yes.
Extraordinarily successful, and I saw it. It was great.
It was great.
Absolutely
yeah.
Great.
Did you ever talk to Ethel Merman about it, about the role?
I didn't. No, I didn't. Mm. But I gave her credit, and I never forget, she sent me a note and she thanked me. So I got so much from her, from listening to her album of her singing. What a lesson that was. And I think these are the things that have fed into my supply of character pieces and bits. It's all there. It's from listening and watching and absorbing. The man on the bus, you know, the woman with the child. All of these things, they all go in to actors if you have the kind of mentality that grabs onto stuff, which you eventually will find a use for. It's because human behavior is one of the most interesting things to observe. And so much has been done about it, of course. But this is what we, as actors, and particularly the ones who play other characters other than themselves, we feed off that. And we do it sometimes without even realizing, and it does go in, and then we pull it out and use it.
It's so interesting, too, to hear you talk about the composers being around, you know, talking to Julie Stein, talking to Stephen Sondheim, because you also starred in The King and I, and I understand Richard Rodgers was there to help you with the songs. What
Richard
a joy.
Richard Rodgers was there with every minute during rehearsals, and thank goodness he was. He was such a help, and I think we did an interesting 3 weeks. I only played it for 3 weeks while they went on holidays, but I did it as a kind of an exercise in playing I think what you would call, I don't know how you describe Mrs. Anna, except it was a more ordinary role, you know. It was not a character role. Mm. She was just a sweet woman, and that was lovely to do.
Do you remember anything in particular Richard Rodgers might have said to you regarding the songs?
I think he was very, very interested in the lyrics. Most composers are. They want to hear the lyrics. They don't want you to lose the lyrics in vocalizing. And sometimes you do lose a lot of lyrics with some singers. But not on Broadway today. The teaching is very specific, and you spit them out.
Let's come back to Stephen Sondheim. What a composer, what a lyricist. And you were asked if you would like to play the female lead in Sweeney Todd. This is a musical that is violent, full of revenge, people are made into pies, and what do you say?
Well, I'll tell you. I was sitting, I was asleep in my house in Connor, in Ireland, when the phone rang, and it was the woman who was in the post office. In those days, we didn't have a direct lines to the international calls, they had to come through the post office. She was sound asleep, poor devil. So was I, we all were. Anyway, she says, I have a phone call from the United States. Well, I said, oh, would you put it on, please? Thank you very much. Sorry to trouble you. And she did, and it was Hal Prince, who was the big Broadway producer who I'd met, never worked for him before. He then proceeded to say, I am planning to do a production of Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street, and the lyrics and music are going to be written by Stephen Sondheim. And we would like you to play the part of Mrs. Lovett. And I said, who's Mr. Lovett? And what does he do? What does she do? Well, she's his wife, and, you know, she's around. She runs the pie shop. The pie shop. Well, she makes the pies. I see. So they proceeded. So I didn't talk very long because I was sort of half asleep. And so I said, well, I'm coming back to New York in about a month's time. I'll come by and see you. So I did. And I went to Stephen Sondheim's house, and he played me one song, The Best Pies in London.
Well, pity a woman alone with limited wind and the worst pies in London. Ah, sir, times is hard, times is hard.
Such a fantastic performance. That is such a difficult song to learn. How did you learn it? The rhythms, everything about it.
Well, I used to get together with a stage manager before we started rehearsals, and we'd go into a different room and with the dough, because you had to do it with the dough, yeah. Otherwise it didn't work.
So difficult. And I mean, it strikes practice. Me watching it that we are now used to Mrs. Lovett as a character, but yes. Angela, you created her. The look, the first person to sing Worst Pies in London. How did you get your head around her as a character?
Ah, good question. An awful lot of it was inherent in the dialogue, you know. The writer was a friend of mine, and Hugh Wheeler was his name, and he really caught the essence of this woman. Every time she opened her mouth, there was no question about, was this the real thing she was? You know, and I appreciated and understood her being a Londoner myself and knowing the Cockney spirit and the general way that Cockneys conducted themselves, even in those days, not today, not anymore, but in the days when I was growing up, those women were out there. They were selling the fish. They were out there on the streets at the East End where my family came from. Originally, my father and my grandfather, and you use all information as actors. We use everything that we see and hear. It all goes in, and we bring it out, and we use it unconsciously. Oftentimes, we don't always know where we get something from. They say, "Well, how did you know?" And it all has to do with observation and what you've seen. I used to watch people in buses. They're very interesting to watch people in buses, particularly today, with all of the carry-on with the iPads, etc. You know, it's so interesting seeing people reacting to messages, and they don't think anybody's watching. You know, so life itself is always interesting. There's always something interesting to look at.
I don't know if there are any Murder, She Wrote fans in, are there? I thought as much. Angela, at this point, you'd been touring a lot, you'd been in movies. You were waiting to settle a little bit. You were coming up to 60 and you were looking for a television series. Tell us how you found Murder, She Wrote.
It was a question of making the decision to go to television. It was a little bit worrying, you know? But I'd come off, as you say, long runs, tours and wanted to stay home for a while. Therefore, we said that we gave the word to my agent, the William Morris Agency. We said, would you consider keeping your eyes open for a script that might suit Angela for a season of work? And they did. They sent me two things, maybe two or three, actually. The first ones they sent, I read them, and I said, you've got to be kidding. They were awful. I mean, they were... if I thought I was going to leave the stage to go to do that, I thought, no, we'll have to forget it. So we sent a rather stern word back to the agency. And they said, you've got to do better than this. So they did. They came back, and then I said, all right, now I'm going to look at into this one called Murder, She Wrote. Murder, She Wrote, yes. So we went over to Universal Studios, and we met this very nice fella who was the producer, who was from CBS, actually, but we met at Universal, and he explained the format of the piece, that I would play this woman who was a writer. She wrote detective stories and etc. So we, I said, well, it sounds like something maybe I could, you know, think about. Maybe I could bring something there. So we made what you call a test. And they put a whole story together and hired actors to flesh it out and to play the various roles. And we made a pilot. And the pilot was taken up, as they say, by Columbia Broadcasting System. And we made a very successful pilot, which ran about, instead of an hour, it ran about an hour and a half. So it was quite a long story. And on the strength of that, it was picked up by the networks, and CBS bought it.
Talk to us about Jessica Fletcher. What was it, do you think, that made her tick? Describe her to us in your head.
Well, she started off as a rather droll, funny kind of character. She was a little bit off-center, you know? And that was a way to go. And I thought, well, that should suit me, you know? But then as I began to play her, I found I wanted her to be more bona fide and real, and not a kind of character person, but a real woman, and who had had a successful marriage, whose husband had died. She had been a teacher. She was a smart, intelligent woman, and she wanted to write, and she could write. So we did it the first few years. She was a little bit cutesy, and I don't know how many of you might have seen the very first ones, but she was a little bit cutesy, which I didn't particularly like when I saw it, although it was beginning already to get an audience. It took quite a while, but finally, as the success of it began to be very apparent, we found we, my husband and I, and my group, including my brother, who was one of the writers, we felt we were in the driver's seat, that we could sort of command attention as to what we would like this show to be. So we worked at it, and we worked at it until it became the show, which it was about a third of the way through, or maybe two-thirds of the way through, not two-thirds. A third or a half, I'd say. She suddenly took over. She dressed better. She was more an outgoing woman of the world rather than, and also a teacher. She was teaching again in New York. And her life, she took a flat in New York, so she wasn't stuck out in Cabot Cove. Now, some people were very disappointed and only wanted her to be stuck out in Cabot Cove. But how many murders can you have in a small town?
I think I read that over the 12-year run of Murder, She Wrote, that Angela Lansbury as Jessica Fletcher solved 274 murders. That's pretty good. It was an extraordinary working schedule for you, Angela. You literally recorded A Murder, She Wrote every 8 days. How did you do it?
Good question. I mean, it was terribly hard work. It really was. It's all I did for 12 years. It's all I did.
Yeah. I've heard you say then that your second home in Cork was almost your reward for all that hard work.
Yes, it was. It was. Yeah. We started it in 91 and we finished it. We finished Murder, She Wrote in 96. And the house was already built by that time, thank God. But that was the that was my reward for doing those extra years.
Mm-hmm. I want to come to B. That's Bedknobs and Broomsticks, Beauty and the Beast and Blithe Spirit. Very briefly, Bedknobs and Broomsticks. Actually, Angela, this was a great leading lady role for you and a great role on screen, one of those roles you were really looking for. Was it a great experience, that movie?
I'm glad you say that because it was one of those films that go on forever, you know, and it's enjoyed by generation after generation of kids. It's kept more kids quiet, not for, you know, not just once, you can run it twice if you're clever, and they'll watch it.
Is it
Why?
True?
Because it has children in it, and that's the lovely combination of magic and children, you know. The two together go very well. And David Tomlinson is thrown in for good measure, who is fabulous.
Is it true one of your songs was cut that you really liked? Is that true?
Yes, a very good number. Yeah. And you know why they had to cut it? Because the film was going into the big movie house on Sixth Avenue. What's it called? Bob. What is that movie house called? The big one. What?
Radio City,
yes. Thank you. What's it called? Honest to God. What's my name, you know? Oh. They had to fit a time frame, and it was just too long. So they took that whole lovely one out.
It's funny, we've been talking about a lot of the roles you've been playing. I'm intrigued as to when you were asked, would you like to play a teapot? You mightn't have ever been expecting that to be on your resume as such as Mrs. Potts, but your voice was so superb. The song itself, Beauty and the Beast, do you remember first hearing it and your reaction?
Oh, yes, I do. I certainly do, because the composer was on the phone to me.
It's Alan Menken.
Alan Menken and his partner, who was alive at that time, yes. And they both came on the line and they said, would you listen to this recording? And they played it to me over the telephone, actually, the first time. And they sang it their style. Tale as old as time, true as it can be, barely even friends. And I said, well, yeah, I'm not really a rock singer. They said, don't worry, you record it the way you think you would want to sing it. You're Mrs. Potts, and you're a teapot, and and you're singing about this monster and the dear little girl. What's her name?
Belle.
Isn't that awful? I think things just go out of my head. I know it like my own. Anyway, so I just sang the way I thought I would want to sing it. They said, that's it. We do it, you know. So we did. We went to New York, we recorded it, and we did one take. And that was it.
All right.
And that's what you hear tonight.
Here is the take. We're going to sit back and listen to Beauty and the Beast. We have it here.
Beast. Tale as old as time, song as old as rhyme, Beauty and the Beast. Off to the cupboard with you now, Chip. It's past your bedtime. Good night, love.
Sadly, the clock has caught up with us. I know we could just chat for hours more. I just wanted to say, Angela Lansbury, I hope you will enjoy this Volta. I hope when you look upon it, you will remember this afternoon fondly, and you will remember that you are held so dear in our hearts. Angela Lansbury, ladies and gentlemen.
Lovely. Thank you. Your voices will ring in my ears forever. Thank you.